I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The acclaimed Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin has written seminal books on Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, and Lyndon Johnson. In her latest book, she examines what each of these men brought to the presidency, how each overcame difficult personal challenges, and the qualities of leadership that they brought to bear to wrest the country out of some of our biggest challenges. From the Civil War to a coal strike that threatened to cripple the national economy, the Depression, World War II, and civil rights legislation in the aftermath of John F. Kennedy's assassination, Goodwin explains how each leader brought the country together in common cause and crafted lasting solutions to complex problems. The book is called Leadership in Turbulent Times. Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me for the hour when Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall on this Friday. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it. In her new book on presidential leadership, Doris Kearns Goodwin asks, do leaders shape the times or do the times summon their leaders? Goodwin argues persuasively that while great presidents were highly ambitious and driven to succeed, they also overcame devastating personal setbacks to lead the country through the most difficult challenges our republic has ever faced. Goodwin chronicles Lincoln's struggles with depression and his handling of the Civil War. She explores how Theodore Roosevelt's philosophy of leadership changed after his young wife and his mother both died on the same day, and how he went on to broker a settlement in a potentially crippling coal strike. She writes of Franklin Roosevelt's struggle with polio and his masterful and decisive moves to end the Depression and to win the Second World War. Goodwin's explication of Lyndon Johnson's unsurpassed achievements in the wake of John F. Kennedy's assassination are informed by her working relationship with LBJ that included a stint as a White House fellow and later assisting President Johnson with his memoirs. She writes about how LBJ rebounded from an election loss in 1941 to be later thrust into the presidency at one of the country's most vulnerable moments. His legislative record, particularly in the area of civil rights, remains unparalleled. Doris Kearns Goodwin has written a best-selling and must-read book about each of these presidents, and in her latest book, she chronicles and examines what each man can teach us about the nature of leadership. Dr. Goodwin demonstrates with authority, acuity, and grace just how important compassionate, informed, and nuanced leadership is to the vitality and the future of our country. So as I mentioned, she has written these books about all of the other presidents, and the way she organizes this one is really masterful. So she basically takes these four presidents, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and then LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, and she does a chapter on each one in their early lives, then a chapter about the adversity that each one encountered in their lives, and then a chapter on each one and how they tackled the big problems that they encountered as they became president. Theodore Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, both entering public life at an early age, 23. Theodore Roosevelt, the youngest president to become president. And of course, he became president, as did Lyndon Johnson, because the predecessor before him, he was serving as vice president, McKinley, was assassinated. That was in 1901. He was 43 years old when he became the president, or 42 years old, rather, when he became the president after McKinley was killed. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson became president in 1963 in November when John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And, of course, the circumstances that each of those men assumed the presidency, very different than anybody who's simply elected to the office. But what each of those men did with their chance, with their opportunity, is really extraordinary. In particular, Miss Goodwin, of course, knew Lyndon Johnson personally, and she was able to chronicle in a very, unique and intimate way how Lyndon Johnson responded to the challenge of, leading the country at a time when the country was bereft. I know I was 9 years old when John F. Kennedy was killed. I was a kid in a Catholic school in Michigan outside of Detroit. And when the nuns told us that the president had been killed, of course, this is the first Catholic president ever elected, it was devastating to that entire community and devastating, of course, to the entire country. That was the first funeral, a mass funeral like that, presidential funeral that we witnessed on television. And then, of course, the events that followed the killing of John F. Kennedy with his alleged assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, being killed by Jack Ruby on live television. It was just an incredible time. And Johnson addressed Congress in a live television address that was in front of the assembled House and Senate in Washington just 4 days after John F. Kennedy was killed. And he was able to summon incredible rhetoric, incredible articulation, incredible spirit to bring the country together and really set out on a path to heal the country and to make good on the promise of John F. Kennedy's programs and potential. Dr. Goodwin describes it as taking a dead man's program and making it into a martyr's cause. So we are having a little trouble connecting with Doris Kearns Goodwin in Boston, but we are working on that. And as soon as we find her, we will heartily welcome her to the program. But I do want to tell you that this is a terrific read, a terrific book. And what's wonderful about it is that it is so incredibly original. This is not simply history. This is beautifully elucidated history, beautifully organized and persuasive theory as to what made each of these men extraordinary and what made the times in which they lived so successful given their qualities of leadership. Again, the book is called Leadership in Turbulent Times, and Doris Kearns Goodwin will be speaking about it Sunday night at the Church of the Redeemer here in Baltimore. We understand that event is sold out, which is perfectly appropriate for the importance of this speech. And I also understand that, Doris, you're with us now from Boston.
With you. Hooray.
Hooray, hooray. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the time. It's great to talk to you. I want to also congratulate you on your beloved Red Sox. They have clinched the AL East.
I know. I was in New York these last couple of days, so everybody around me was hoping they wouldn't clinch it while they were in New York. But it happened.
But it happened. And, I'd love to give you time to gloat about that, because here in Baltimore, we, of course, set different kinds of records this year with numbers of losses and stuff. But because your book is so good and because I liked it so much, we're going to spend time talking about the book rather than your beloved Red Sox and our beleaguered Baltimore Orioles. So these four men whom you had studied, for a big chunk of your career, there are some things that you identify, leadership traits that you identify that are common to all of them. Things like they all had great memories. They were good at storytelling. They were empathic people. But you also say that they were united by a fierce ambition and an inordinate drive to succeed. Do you think that that's really just fundamentally something that every person aspiring to be president would need to have to start off with?
I actually think that having a fierce ambition and a drive to succeed is fundamental to success in any field. It's that willingness to persevere through difficulties. It's the desire to somehow keep growing in whatever you're doing. It's interesting. Teddy Roosevelt once said there are two kinds of success in the world. The first one is somebody who's born with a talent that no matter what you do, it's going to show itself, like a great poet. And you can't really do it if just by hard work. But most people, he said, have ordinary abilities that they develop to an extraordinary degree through hard, sustained work. So I do think that fierce ambition and the perseverance to get through tough times is a fundamental foundation before anybody can become, much less a president, a leader.
And the tough times that each of these men endured, Lincoln, a devastating depression that lasted for quite a while. This is well before he was the president. Franklin Roosevelt, of course, had polio. And then Theodore Roosevelt, this extraordinary moment in which his first child is born. And within 24 hours, both his mother, who was only 49 years old, and his wife died. They you know, somehow got themselves out of that devastating sadness. And then you also put in that list Lyndon Johnson losing an election in the 1940s for Senate. And you mentioned that in one sense it could sound like a little hyperbole to put that kind of, you know, an election loss in the same league as these other things. But given who Johnson was, I guess it belongs in the list, doesn't it?
Well, he considered the loss a repudiation of himself. I mean, that was at a time in his life when moving up and getting power and becoming a leader was who he was. And it does seem crazy compared to these other kinds of traumas that the people went through. And it sent him in a different direction. I mean, the other three, because of the vulnerabilities they suffered, they understood themselves better. They came through a hard time. I mean, Ernest Hemingway said, "Everyone is broken by life, but some people are stronger in the broken places." And that occurred, I think, for the first three. With Lyndon Johnson, after he lost that election, he turned backward in a certain sense. He'd been a progressive New Dealer up till that time. He'd brought electricity to the Hill Country. He'd been the head of the National Youth Administration. And then he just went for wealth at that point and for privilege and became more conservative to fit the Texas election that he hoped he would run the next time. But the interesting thing is that he gains power. He becomes majority leader, the most powerful majority leader ever in the history of our country. And then in 1955, he suffers yet another difficulty. He has a massive heart attack. And he came out of that depression, and he said to himself, "What if I died now? How would I be remembered? What would I be remembered for?" And then he sort of got back to his roots, and he engineered a civil rights bill through the Senate. And then, of course, when he became president, civil rights became the one thing he hoped he would be remembered for, and it has turned out to be so.
As you think about the scope of all 45 presidents, are there others that strike you as also sharing the traits that you talk about with the two Roosevelts, Lincoln and Johnson? I mean, is the historical record, for example, complete enough to understand whether or not people like Jefferson and Adams and Washington at the beginning of the Republic, you know, had these qualities as well? Do you think these qualities are unique to these four?
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm sure there are others. George Washington, Jefferson, Harry Truman. I just chose these four because I knew them the best. And it's a really personal thing to try and figure out, when did they think of themselves as a leader? What was the nature of their ambition? What are these things they went through? And I knew that if I tried to do a large list of presidents, my knowledge would not be deep enough for it. And I think partly, too, each time I finished one of the presidents over these last 40, 50 years, and then I had to move all of his books aside to the next room to make room for the next guy, as I moved from Franklin Roosevelt maybe to Teddy and Taft, I used to feel I was leaving an old boyfriend behind. I felt a little guilty. So this time I could bring all four guys and keep them there and just move from one room to the other when I needed my research. And so I figured if I could just use the knowledge I already had, because it was going to take a lot of new thinking to figure out how they became leaders and how they led, I'd be better off than trying to stretch it out beyond that.
You mentioned in terms of Lincoln the distinction between what scholars have identified as what they call transformational leadership or transactional leadership. Explain what that distinction is.
Well, I think when we think of transactional leadership, it's making bargains with people. I'll make a deal with you, and I'll give you this if you give me that. And what and that's necessary in politics. And Lincoln, even in terms of his leadership, he was willing to make sure that votes were counted. He was willing to give certain things to people in order to make them vote the right way. Every leader has to do that in politics. But what transformational leadership meant is that once he decided to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, he knew that he had to transform the attitudes first of his cabinet, many of whom were not for it in the beginning and thought it would extend the war, make peace impossible, and he had to transform the leadership and people's attitudes in the army, because only 3 out of 10 soldiers wanted emancipation. They thought they were fighting for the Union, not for emancipation, and the country at large. And somehow through his leadership, I mean, for example, his leadership of the cabinet, he had explained to them for months, he debated about the issue of emancipation. He let them have their say, which is what a leader needs to do. He anticipated their viewpoints. And then finally, when he made his decision, he went back to them, and he was hoping they would hold together as a unit. But he said if they didn't, they could write a written objection to what he was about to do to issue the proclamation. But by that time, they so respected his leadership that they were willing to put their private objections aside and appear as a team before the country for this big change that was taking place with the Emancipation Proclamation. And then with the Army, he had visited the soldiers so many times. He had told them if they had any complaints, they could come visit him in Washington, and several thousand did. So when he made the announcement that we're now fighting for emancipation, not just Union, they were willing to go along with him. And similarly, the country at large, there was a lot of complaint at the beginning. Northern legislatures even wanted to secede from New England, thinking that's where all this emancipation stuff comes from. And eventually he had to win elections. He had to make people agree with what he was doing, and he was able to. So that means he transformed attitudes, and people thought differently about what the war was being fought for before he started.
And, you know, the title of your book about Lincoln, A Team of Rivals, says it all when it comes to the cabinet that he assembled. And you also talk about Lincoln's enormous emotional intelligence and how that is a key factor in the way that he juggled the incredible number of competing interests that were at play.
No, absolutely. In fact, the decision he makes to put these chief rivals into his cabinet, which he comes to on the first night when he wins the election, he decides, I need the stronger people around me with more experience, with more education, more celebrities. So the three top people, Seward, Chase, and Bates, were all better known than he, and they all thought they should have been president instead of him. But he had the internal confidence, Lincoln did, to know that if he could get to know them and if he could lead them, that they would follow him. And because they represented radical, conservative, moderate opinion in the country at large, if he could keep them together, he'd be keeping the country, the North, together. Although some people might say, as Lyndon Johnson did, he might have put it in less noble language what Lincoln was trying to do by saying, it's better to have your enemies inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. He had a colorful way of speaking, of course.
I love the anecdote you have about one of President Lincoln's habits was when he got really mad and he was really angry, he would write what he called a hot letter. And he would put in this letter everything that upset him about this person or that person. And then he would put that letter aside. This was incredibly disciplined, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, for example, after General Meade failed to follow up with General Lee's army after the victory at Gettysburg, despite telegrams going to him and saying, you must get Lee's army, he wrote him a long letter saying, I'm immeasurably distressed after Lee's army escaped, that the war is now going to go on year after year, month after month. But then he knew that it would paralyze the general who was still in the field, so he just put it aside and never sent it. It was never even seen until the 20th century when his papers were opened, and underneath was the notation, never sent and never signed. And there were dozens of that kind of letter. It's interesting, FDR had his own way, too, of figuring out how to get rid of his anger or emotions. He would write like five or six drafts of his fireside chats, and they'd always read them aloud to the assembled speechwriters. And in the first draft of a speech, when he was really angry with an isolationist congressman, he called him a traitor. He said terrible things about him. And the young speechwriter was there and saying, I can't believe he's going to do that. And the older speechwriter said, don't worry. Wait till the second draft. His name will no longer be there. Wait till the third draft. It'll be a nice guy. By the fourth draft, all his sweetness and light. But he got it out of his system. It was interesting. When I was talking to President Obama about his exit interview, which I did for Vanity Fair, and we were talking about the hot letters, I said, do you ever think of doing that? And he said, what do you mean? I do it all the time. And I said, what do you mean? And he said he writes letters all the time to people when he's angry, and then he crumbles them up and puts them in the wastebasket.
Yeah.
So it would be fun to find those letters someday.
Yeah, venting, I mean, has its place, doesn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
You also talk about Lincoln's enormous, and again, I guess this goes back to emotional intelligence, but his enormous capacity to understand his own gifts and sometimes to even keep those gifts in abeyance. You write this beautiful phrase that you say, in a world of tinder, Lincoln was determined to hold his rhetorical gifts in abeyance in order to reach across factions and avoid a single spark that could be set loose or could set loose an avoidable conflagration. So he knew the power of his rhetoric. He knew, I mean, we all know the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural and the great power of his rhetoric, but he also knew when to hold it back and to make sure he didn't light things up too quickly.
No, absolutely. In fact, people sometimes look at the Emancipation Proclamation, the wording of it, and it seems rather flat, and they wonder, why did he not make a great speech at that moment when he was issuing the proclamation? But he wanted it to be a legal document as much as it could be, that it was arguing that because he was commander-in-chief, he had powers of military necessity to issue this proclamation because the slaves were helping the South and this would rebalance the situation. So the last thing he wanted was to be making a big rhetorical push when he knew the country still had to be persuaded for it. That would come later. But right now he just wanted to ground that in legal language. So somebody said, one historian said, it read like a bill of lading. It was that flat and that boring. But he knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, the interesting thing about Lincoln is he understood every audience that he was speaking for. And most of the time he'd be telling stories. I mean, we remember those beautiful speeches with the language that remains with us still. But most of his speeches were set in terms of telling the story of where the country had been, where it was going, what it should be going toward. And he never hardly spoke extemporaneously. When he was president, even though he could debate anybody easily, the Stephen Douglas debate showed that. There's a moment when somebody yells out from the crowd, "You're two-faced, Mr. Lincoln." And he said, "If I had two faces, do you think I'd be wearing this face?" But when he was president, he didn't want to speak extemporaneously. He was so afraid that words mattered. So that when even soldiers would come or people would come to celebrate a Union victory, and he'd come out on the balcony in the White House, and he would simply thank the soldiers and sing the songs with them because he wanted to use those occasions for prepared words so that words matter, something that we could use today, I think, in our political dialogue,
yes,
that sense
yes,
of
indeed.
The importance of words.
Indeed. Doris Kearns Goodwin, her latest book is called Leadership in Turbulent Times. We'll have more with Doris Kearns Goodwin after a quick break, and we'll begin taking some of your calls and comments at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, Scott Shane of the New York Times joins me. We're going to talk about what we now understand about Russian efforts to subvert the 2016 election. The Times posted last night a long and very extensive piece on that subject, and we'll pick Scott's brain about it. Scott was part of the team that put that story together. Plus, Master Chef John Shields will be here, and he's going to talk about his latest literary and culinary offering, a new book called The New Chesapeake Kitchen. It's another installment of What You Got Cookin'. If you've just joined us today, we're talking with the acclaimed presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about her latest book, and it's one that I cannot recommend highly enough. It's terrific. It's called Leadership in Turbulent Times. Our number, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. So Doris, I want to talk a little bit about Teddy Roosevelt. You say that you mentioned that both he and Lincoln were 23 years old when they made their first forays into the political world, but after that, the similarities end.
Oh, correct. I mean, obviously, Teddy Roosevelt came from a much more privileged background, while Lincoln had to scour the countryside for books and lay his hands on anything he could, running around the country to get it. Teddy had a library that he could take the book down from. If he wanted a book that wasn't there, it would magically appear to him. And when he ran for office the first time, you're right, at 23, same as Lincoln, Lincoln had to put himself forward. In those days when Lincoln was doing it, there wasn't a party that chose you to nominate you. You just simply wrote a handbill to say, "I want to run for office." And his, even in the handbill, said that everyone has his peculiar ambition. Mine is to be esteemed of by my fellow man. I mean, he already had an exalted sense of what political life could do. But he thought he might lose, and he did lose. And he said, "If I lost, however, I'll try 5 or 6 more times until it's so humiliating, I promise I'll never try again." But then Teddy Roosevelt was simply approached, really, by the political bosses. He lived in the Silk Stocking area of New York, and they thought it would be a good person to run because his name was a good name. His father had been a philanthropic leader in New York. And when he went in, he said, honestly, he looked back on it later, I went in for the adventure of it. I wasn't really going in with the consciousness of trying to make lives better for other people. But once he got into the state legislature, and that's what politics at its best can do, it involved him with understanding other people's lives. He went into tenements. He went through the slums. He saw children in factories. And then he developed what he called fellow feeling, or empathy, I think we might call it, and he became a much more enlarged leader as a result. But in Lincoln, it was natural, and in him, it had to be developed.
You talk about two sort of views, schools of thought about presidential power. The first is identified with James Buchanan, and it basically says that the president is the servant of the Congress. And the other is exemplified by Lincoln, who considered the presidency to be the stewardship of the people. That's a pretty dramatic distinction between two ways of looking at government. What was, in terms of Teddy Roosevelt's tenure and particularly his work fixing or solving the coal strike of 1902, which you write about extensively, how did his approach to the presidency inform all that?
Yeah, well, what happens to Teddy Roosevelt in 1902 is there's this massive coal strike. It's the most formidable deadlock in the history of the country. The miners are protesting really terrible conditions in the mines. And the coal barons, who are no longer miners owning mines in their own areas, so they become big, you know, people swallowing up smaller companies, so they're distant from their from the miners, they don't want to budge. And it goes on for 6 months. And had it gone on any longer, in New England, coal was the major source of heat. So hospitals were even beginning to close down and schools were closing down. But Teddy's problem was this was the laissez-faire era, the turn of the 20th century. No one thought there was any right of a president to even get involved in a private dispute between the owners and the miners. And there was no legal precedent for doing so. So he had to come on with his philosophy, as you just described, to say that I'm the steward of the people, not of the Congress, not of even what other presidents have done before. And he got that authority in his mind from Lincoln. In fact, during that entire summer when the coal strike was going on and he was trying to figure out what to do, he read these 12 volumes of Nicolay and Hay on Abraham Lincoln. And he kept saying, I'm learning from him. So he takes the risk of inviting the coal barons and the miners to the White House, the first time ever labor management had been at a White House meeting. And he's so smart the way he handles it. In the middle of the meeting, the miner head, this guy John Mitchell, who was a very good leader in his own right, makes the suggestion that we will go to arbitration. If you appoint a commission, Mr. President, we will abide by the results. We will trust the results of that commission to arbitrate our differences, etc. But the coal miners, the coal barons, rather, refuse to even talk to him. They won't even enter in a dialogue because they don't think they should be in the same room with him. But Teddy had taken the precaution at the beginning of saying he was going to have a stenographer take notes of the meeting. And after the meeting was over and it went nowhere because the coal baron said, we can't deal with this guy, he had the pamphlet published that night, and it obviously brought public opinion on the side of the miners, and it put pressure on the coal barons to do something about it. But even then, they wouldn't deal with Teddy. They wouldn't deal with the miners. So Teddy goes to J.P. Morgan, who was the financier for all these coal owners, and he said, how about if you put the idea forward? And if he put it forward, then it would be face-saving for the owners of the coal mines. And that's what happened. The arbitration happened. The settlement was made for both sides. And he made a precedent that presidents were responsible for the country. And that's what he kept arguing. You have the miners on one side. You have the coal owners the other. But I'm responsible to the people. And it worked. And it was probably one of the pivotal moments in his presidency because it brought about the square deal for the rich and the poor, the capitalist and the wage worker, which was his mantra during his presidency.
And I'm also fascinated by one of the things that you list as a tenet of great leadership in regards to Teddy Roosevelt, leave a record behind for the future. Because the day after the strike ended, Roosevelt writes a 3,000-word letter to a senator from Massachusetts explaining all of what happened. He himself was an historian. You, of course, are, as an historian, maybe you're just, you know, inclined to want everybody to leave behind a record.
I do, indeed.
Makes your job a little easier.
Keep diaries, write letters, yeah. Always keep writing.
But, Bimi, why is that? Why do you list that as one of the tenets of a great leader? That's interesting.
Well, I think what he knew is that he was creating a precedent for the future, and he wanted people who would be similarly having another situation like this to learn from the lessons of what he had learned, both from the difficulties in the early stages of this coal strike and then the way it finally got resolved. And in fact, that's what history should be able to do, is to, by looking at past situations and how leaders handled them, it's like learning from our parents or grandparents. Presidents can learn from one another. And in fact, and I suppose there's something about Teddy also wanting to write the history himself. You know, Churchill always said, I'll do well in history because I'm going to write it.
Yeah.
And I suppose Teddy had that sense as well. I mean, he did have a sense of his own centrality. I mean, his daughter Alice made that wonderful comment that he so loved being in the center of attention that he wanted to be the baby at the baptism and the bride at the wedding and the corpse at the funeral. But in this case, interestingly, in the coal strike, he, like Lincoln holding himself back from his gift of language, he held himself back from intervening too early, from being too aggressive, so that he could build the public will to support what he was hoping to do, which was to bring them together in some sort of arbitration.
My guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her newest book is called Leadership in Turbulent Times. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Doris, let's shift to Teddy's cousin, Franklin, who someone described as a second-class intellect but a first-class temperament. So these two men operated very differently. And Teddy, the voracious reader, you write that Franklin, not so much. He learned more from listening than from reading.
Yeah, I think he was just incurably social, Franklin Roosevelt was, so that he wanted to be talking to people. Even when he was a child, he'd rather read aloud than read by himself. There was about him just a natural desire to listen to other people, to talk to other people. And obviously it got strengthened once he got the polio and he couldn't go around the country the same way. He would bring all sorts of people into the White House so that he could extract their ideas and learn from them. But I think the comment that was made about him having a second-class intellect and a first-class temperament is probably not even fair to his intellect, because he wasn't an academic student at Harvard or Columbia Law, but he had an incredible problem-solving mind, which turned out to be so important given the situations that he would face. And as you pointed out earlier, though, there's no question that the thing he went through with polio expanded his empathy. He emerged much more warm-hearted. He'd been always a naturally interesting politician. He was handsome. There was a certain arrogance about him. But once he got the polio and he had to go through years of striving just to try and walk on his own power again, which he never was really able to do, it softened some of him. It made him feel connected to other people to whom fate had dealt an unkind hand. And he learned humility, which means that awareness of his own limitations. He was able to share those limitations with all of his fellow polio patients at Warm Springs, where he became Doc Roosevelt. He taught them to have joy in life again. They would play water polo and tag. He had wheelchair dances. They'd go to the movies and have cocktail hours at night. And it just, empathy is, to me, the most important quality in a leader, and it's a mark of temperament, if you have it or not, meaning your ability to put yourself in other people's shoes and understand what they're thinking and feeling so that you can deal with them. And his empathy was expanded extraordinarily by this. And he said, at one point, somebody said, how can you deal with the pressures of the presidency? He said, if you spent 2 years just trying to move your big toe, you will learn that you've got humility and you have patience, which you might not have had before.
You know, and when I walked into the studio today, I swore that I was going to do as little talking about the present occupant of the White House as possible, because you write so beautifully about these other four. We do have an email from Kirk who says, Dr. Goodwin, you've devoted much of your life providing us with a better understanding of some of our greatest leaders from the past. Contrast is frequently informing. So could you spend a moment discussing our most significant failures? Can you produce a measure for comparing the depths plumbed by the present occupant of the White House?
Well, let's just stick with the empathy thing right now, because I think that is a contrast that is remarkably aware if we just look at what's happening. You know, even though, as I said, Teddy Roosevelt may not have had the empathy at the beginning that Lincoln was naturally born with, I think some people are born with empathy, he's a little kid and he sees his other friends putting hot coals on turtles to make them wiggle. And he said, that's just wrong. And he told them that's wrong. There's a moment when he's walking home at night and there's somebody drunk in a ditch and all the friends walk by and he goes back and picks him up and carries him to a place where he could have a fire and warm up. So there was a naturalness to that empathy, but other people develop it over time. Teddy developed it when he went into the slums. FDR developed it even more through his polio. And it's empathy that one worries about not seeing in President Trump. I mean, we saw it in this whole run-up to the hurricane in North Carolina, when instead of telling us what were the preparations for the hurricane, he went back to Maria, where he had not, the situation had not been handled well. How much better if he'd just been able to say, how I wish we'd been able to do better with Maria. It was a difficult situation in Puerto Rico, but we've learned from it, and I've acknowledged that, and we'll be better. Instead, he had to dispute how many people had died and saying that there were more people the Democrats were claiming who died that he hadn't. And the people in Puerto Rico wanted, that's the last thing they wanted to hear, who had lost somebody in their lives, that maybe the numbers were less than they were supposed to be. And that's that desire somehow to connect to other people. It either comes from experience or internally, and I think it's the thing we're seeing missing so much now in President Trump.
Doris Kearns Goodwin. The book is called Leadership in Turbulent Times. We'll have more with Doris Kearns Goodwin when we return from a break. You can join us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
All I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. The greatest leader of our time has been struck down by the foulest deed of our time.
Lyndon Johnson addressing Congress on the 27th of November, 1963. That's just 4 days after John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. If you've just joined us, my guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. I'm Tom Hall. Doris Goodwin helped President Johnson with his memoirs. Her book, Team of Rivals, was the basis for Lincoln, the Academy Award-nominated movie by Steven Spielberg that starred Daniel Day-Lewis in the title role. Spielberg's production company is currently developing Dr. Goodwin's 2013 bestseller, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Dr. Goodwin won the Pulitzer Prize for her book on Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and her critically acclaimed book on LBJ called Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream will be re-released next year. Her latest book is a terrific compendium of insights into these four great presidents, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, and LBJ. It's called Leadership in Turbulent Times. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So, Doris, your husband of 42 years, Richard Goodwin, died just in May. Where were you in the process of this book? It must have been incredibly personally difficult to get this project to fruition, given the personal tragedy that you were enduring.
No, in fact, you know, what made it doubly difficult was that I happened to be at the part of the book in the epilogue where I was writing about the deaths of all four people. And so to be trying to absorb, you know, my husband of 42 years, who was so involved in so many of my books that I worked on, he was working on his own book about the country and how he loved the country's ideals and his worries about where it was right now. Hopefully I'll be able to finish that book because he was 3/4 done. But the same theme that I feel for myself in this book, he felt in his, which was that, you know, we have to remember that, as he would say, America's not as fragile as it might seem. He had lived through a lot. He had lived through the Depression. He'd lived through World War II. And he'd seen all the ups and downs of working for John Kennedy, finding him assassinated, working with LBJ, and then turning against the war in Vietnam, as my husband did, and then being with Bobby Kennedy when he died. And yet he still believed that America was strong and would get through the difficulties that we were going through right now. And in some ways, that's the theme of my book, in a way, even though it doesn't mention the president or the current situation or the Congress today. It's the idea that we've been through such tough times before. I mean, we think we're in the worst of times. People will often stop me because I'm an historian and say, has it ever been worse?
Yeah.
And I can tell them, of course it has been. I mean, when you think of Lincoln coming into office and 600,000 people are going to die, he said if he'd ever thought he was what he was going to go through, he could have lived through it. Teddy Roosevelt, the struggle during the Industrial Revolution was far more virulent than it is today. I mean, the workers and the strikes that were going on and the violence in the streets, and it was much like today in the sense that the country was being shaken by the Industrial Revolution as we are today by the tech revolution and globalization. There were new inventions that people felt the country was moving too fast, the telephone, the automobile, the telegraph, just as we might feel that today with everything that's going on. And the rural areas felt cut off from the cities in those days. And somehow Teddy Roosevelt was able to channel that emotion into rational reform. And as we've said, of course, FDR comes in when the economy is rock bottom. People are standing in long lines to take their deposits out of the bank. And there's a feeling that capitalism is at risk. And then LBJ comes in when the civil rights movement is building up, but they cannot get the bill through the Congress. There's no hope that JFK is going to be able to get it through because the Southerners controlled the committee. And yet, in the speech that you just referenced, the first speech he gives 4 days after President Kennedy was killed, he makes the pledge that this is the number one priority for the memory of JFK would be the passage of the Civil Rights Bill to end segregation in the South. And it was an extraordinarily risky thing to do because most of his advisors said, you're not going to be able to get it through. You'll be a failed president. It's 11 months from now, and you're going to only have a certain amount of coinage to expend as a president. You oughtn't expend it on this. And his answer was, well, then what the hell is the presidency for?
Yeah.
There comes a time in every career where you throw in all your stack, and this is the time. And my husband and I had spent so much time talking about Lyndon Johnson. We sort of fought about him most of our lives because he was so angry and hurt when Johnson turned toward the war in Vietnam, because all the Great Society legislation that Dick had been part of, he'd been involved with all of Johnson's civil rights and Great Society bills. He'd written the Great We Shall Overcome speech, the Great Society speech, all the Alliance for so many things, and he felt that that was such a turning. But by the end of my husband's life, too, he'd come to see what I had known sort of early on, because I saw him in that sadder time of his life, that what he accomplished was extraordinary. And though the war in Vietnam would always cut that legacy in two, when you think of civil rights, voting rights, fair housing, NPR, PBS, Head Start, immigration reform, aid to education, Medicare, Medicaid, any one of those accomplishments would have meant a legacy for any other president. And he pushed the Congress, and he knew that Congress so well, and he wouldn't stop, and he wouldn't stop until the war stopped him.
And you yourself got off to an interesting and kind of rough start with the president. You were named to be, with President Johnson, you were named to be a White House fellow. And right after you started, you published an article very much condemning the Vietnam War. How did you write that ship?
Well, the timing wasn't very good. What had happened is I was a graduate student at Harvard when I was selected as a White House fellow, but I had written an article with a friend of mine. We were involved in the anti-war movement like so many young people would, send it to the New Republic, and we just hadn't heard anything. And then we had a big dance at the White House the night we were selected. President Johnson did dance with me. Not that peculiar. There were only three women out of the 16 White House fellows. But as he twirled me around the floor, he whispered that he wanted me to be assigned directly to him in the White House. But then this article appeared 2 days later in the New Republic suddenly with the title, How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power. So I was certain he would kick me out of the program. But instead, surprisingly, he said, oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can. So I did end up working for him in the White House and then accompanying him to his ranch, and it made all the difference. I mean, it's why I became a presidential historian, to be able to talk to a president so many hours, which I never would have had he been at the height of his power. But there he was so lonely at the ranch, and he needed to talk, and I was there to listen.
You talk about this speech that he gave right after President Kennedy was killed, and you say it's a great example of several traits of leadership that you identify. Number one, make a dramatic start. Number two, lead with your strengths. And number three, simplify the agenda. He was able to sort of coalesce all those three things in that one very powerful speech.
Absolutely. I mean, he knew that his strength was the Congress. He knew that Congress. He knew every single congressman. He knew the senators. And if he could get Congress working again, interestingly, before Kennedy died, there was a felt sense in the country that Congress was broken, much as we've been feeling in these last years. Not a single one of Kennedy's major domestic initiatives had gotten through. And the Southerners controlled so much of it, they couldn't get any kind of bipartisanship. And so he said if he knew if he could do that, then he would have the reins of power in his hands. So by going up to a joint session right away was the exact right thing to do. And then he just started to work. He had every single congressman over to the White House in those first 6 months in groups of 30. And then Lady Bird would take the wives, mostly wives, then on a tour, and he would, with cigars and drinks, talk to the guys. He would call the congressman at 9 in the morning, at 12, at midnight. He even called a senator once at 2 a.m., and he said, I hope I didn't wake you up. And the senator said, no, I was just lying here staring at the ceiling, hoping my president would call. But eventually he was able to get the minority leader, Everett Dirksen, to bring the Republicans that he needed to break the filibuster, because in those days it was 67 votes and the Southern Democrats were split apart. And he promises Dirksen everything. And earmarks, you could do whatever you wanted in those days, ambassadorships, pardons, whatever you want. But more importantly, he goes to Everett Dirksen and he says, you know, Dirksen, if you come with me on this bill and you bring Republicans to help break that filibuster, 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. How could Dirksen resist? Yeah. And he did bring them, and we got a bipartisan support for that most important bill that ended segregation. And then he doesn't stop. He feels that fulfillment of, oh, my God, this is something to do something with your power. And the next year he goes for voting rights, and that's when the We Shall Overcome speech that my husband worked on. It was another joint session of Congress talk, and it was an extraordinary speech. It's one of the most beautiful speeches, I think, in the 20th century, and it produced a voting rights bill. That's what speeches do. They're not just pretty language, but they mobilize people to action.
Yeah, and apropos of the great Dirksen story, you list one of the tenets that Johnson displayed so often was that he was able to set forth a compelling picture of the future. So he's talking about Mr. Dirksen's personal future, and then he was also able to set forth, tell the story and set forth the picture of what America could be like if we had the Voting Rights Act, if we had the Fair Housing Act, if we had Medicare, et cetera.
I think that's right. Even to the South, he made that picture, you know, that if the South could come up with these kinds of changes, then the whole region would be a region that could go forward into the future, not to be hung on to the past. You know, and he'd paint a picture of the economic development that come to the South, what it would like to be a part of the Union, not be a separate section of the country. And that's, I think that's true of many leaders. It was interesting during the early days before World War II, when America had to sort of catch up to Germany with our weapons and supplies. We had only 4,000 planes, and Germany had 50,000 planes. And Roosevelt, FDR, decides, I'm going to set a target. I'm going to say we're going to have 50,000 planes this year created. And people said, you're crazy. We can't possibly do that. We're only producing 4,000 a year. And he said, people need a target. They need to visualize something. We will have caught up to Germany. And by God, they did it as a result of that.
And he also, of course, knew, as Roosevelt did, the inner workings of the government bureaucracy. I mean, he understood, Johnson understood, you write about how he got from Roosevelt. He understood that the cumbersome organization of government is simply not equipped to solve some complex problems that cut across departmental jurisdictions. He knew how the gears worked, and he knew which gears to tweak and when.
Oh, exactly. I mean, LBJ would have maps and charts on his wall where he knew every single committee and which bill was in what stage at that committee and who was responsible for getting it up to the next step. You know, and then when he wanted to hurry something along, even if a bill got passed, then he knew it had to get printed. So he would call the printing people in the government printing office. You work nights and now don't wait a week for that bill because I got to get it through. And then he would get it distributed. I mean, he just was like a mechanic.
Yeah.
He understood every process of this mass production line. And in the end came out these extraordinary bills.
Yeah, and it's amazing to think that there are so many people in this last election who thought it would be a really good idea to have a complete outsider come into the White House, a business person who knew nothing about the roles of government and the reins of government. Interesting.
You know, it just shows how badly people were feeling about the political order, that they wanted to go in an entirely different direction.
Yeah.
But well, it's a problem if you don't have experience.
Doris, this has really been a delight. I really appreciate it, and I just love this book. So congratulations, and thanks so much. Hope we can talk again soon.
Oh, I'm so happy you do. Thank you so much.
Doris Kearns Goodwin. The new book is called Leadership in Turbulent Times. She will be speaking at the Church of the Redeemer here in Baltimore Sunday night. That event is sold out. That's it for us today. Coming Coming up Monday, Scott Shane of the New York Times on the latest reporting on Russian interference in the 2016 election. Plus, what you got cooking with Chef John Shields. He's got a new book called The New Chesapeake Kitchen. Lunch today was provided by Bottoms Up Bagels, a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. They're available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets and online at bottomsupbagels.com. Our team here at Midday consists of Luke Spicknall, Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, Kathleen Cahill, Jamila Krempel, and Austin Coughlin. I'm Tom Hall. I appreciate your listening. We will look forward to being with you next week. Have a great weekend.